The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
On our previous edition of UWM Today, we talked about the Student Startup Challenge, a program that helps students take their ideas and turn them into businesses. It's an amazing way to give UWM students a real-world experience of transforming a concept, perhaps, into a company. On today's program, we're going to continue the conversation, this time with a focus on the creative process itself. Our guest is Nathaniel Stern, Associate Professor of Art and Design in the Peck School of the Arts. Nathaniel is a co-founder of the Student Startup Challenge, bridging that world of art and design with other academic disciplines like engineering and science. Welcome, Nathaniel. Good to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me here.
So last week we talked to a student and to a couple of the people, Ilya Avdi and also Brian Thompson, about the way in which this great Student Startup Challenge offers opportunities to students. You were one of the founding members of it, and what I think might be of real interest is, how does an artist get the idea of working with an engineer or a scientist or a biologist on projects that could be commercialized?
It's a really good question. I think the disciplines that we're in today weren't always around. I mean, when we think of Michelangelo and Leonardo, we think of them as scientists and as artists, both one and the same. And I think what we forget about artists is that we're all also craftspeople and artisans that work very well with materials and have to do all kinds of calculations in order to make what it is we do. I personally have both an MFA and a PhD. My PhD is actually from an engineering department. And so I'm a coder. I work a lot in C++. I work a lot with electronics. I can solder better than I can work a drill. So I'm a bit of an awkward artist in that regard, although I think awkward artist might be redundant. Ilya speaks the language of art as well. I mean, it really came from this great collaboration with Ilya Avdiv, where we were teaching a product design class together. And this goes back to Mike Lovell, where he basically, when he took over as the dean of engineering, visited us over in Peck School of the Arts and said, who of you are working with technology? He knew that there's already so many artists who are returning to working again with engineering principles. And there was a number of us that went. And when he mentioned the product realization class, which is a partnership with industry, where industry sponsors actually buy into the class with a prototype idea, and then he put together teams of engineers to build those prototypes, I said, no, you need artists and you need designers on those teams as well.
And yet I think a lot of people listening to the program might say, well, doesn't the artist get involved in the packaging and the marketing and in the way that you sell this? But point is that they have to be involved at the ground floor of the product itself.
From the very beginning. And I think it's part of the ideation process, right? That it's very standard for especially a mathematically minded person to find a solution and to as quickly as possible. And that's not always the best solution to go from point A to point B in a direct line. Sometimes the best solution might only be found via a circuitous route. And so part of what we teach in this class is to follow the meandering path, chase rainbows, dance and think on your feet, go somewhere else. And I like to think of it as a scaffolding experience. The scaffolding is useless when it comes to the final building, and yet it's absolutely necessary in order to build what's on the inside. And sometimes only bad ideas can lead to good ideas, or at least the best ideas. An example I love to give was that I found online a few years ago, and I give this example in class, was a bunch of guys who were sitting around a table talking about the fact that the cell phone towers were freezing way up north, and they stopped working whenever they froze. And they shot through so many different ideas of vibrating from the ground and hitting it from the bottom up or throwing heaters. And then some idea was like, I know, we'll put honey at the top of the towers, and then bears will climb up to get the honey, and they'll knock off the ice as they're climbing it, which is a terribly stupid idea, and everyone sat around laughing. But then it turned out that the answer was vibrations from the top down. And so they wound up just flying helicopters over these cell phone towers, and just the vibrations and the wind from the copters knocked off the ice. And they never would have come up with that idea if they hadn't been joking around with the first. And so artists need to play a part of that. The tangential thing that came out of this as well is that a lot of the mechanical and industrial engineers nowadays work on screen. They don't work with their hands quite as much as they used to. And so, in fact, the artists, what they also had to offer was that they build stuff and they make stuff very often a lot better with their hands as craftspeople than the engineers do.
So you've got a virtual workbench rather than the real one that we might have seen our parents or grandparents designing or building or constructing off of.
Absolutely. And I mean, that happens in both sides, both art and engineering. You see that. So they learn a lot from each other. And what we teach in the class is that there's not just one leader who will emerge, but actually there are different moments of the process that do need linear thinking, and there are moments that need more lateral thinking, and that different kinds of leadership needs to emerge at each phase of the process. So very early on, in fact, the second week of class, we start doing these experiential exercises of things like solving puzzles, problem solving, working with Legos, and each one of those has a slightly different tinge to it in terms of the kind of thinking you need to do, how comfortable you are, right? Lego building is open-ended. There isn't a set task, whereas working with a puzzle is a set, you know, there's only one answer. Who's going to lead in that moment? How are we best going to solve this? And how does that translate into working on a team later with a real-world problem?
And again, in this case, you have students from very diverse backgrounds. It's not just a group of art students in one room and engineers in another room. In the product realization labs, you bring those two sides together. In some people's minds, you're bringing two disparate parts together.
Absolutely. And in fact, I would argue more than that. I mean, class that we're running now, there's 40 students. They range from mechanical engineering to digital studio practice. We have 7 students from China in the class, 4 students from India in the class. There's industrial engineering there, computer science there. There's design and visual communication in the class. We have a photography student in the class. So even within those groups of students, it's fairly diverse.
You work with a lot of industries. You mentioned the fact that we have companies that partner with the university to help this process along. Was it a tough sell getting businesswomen and businessmen who might be more from a more traditional background to realize that this sort of free-for-all of ideas with this mixing and matching could work?
We have to train them a little bit, I'd say.
Because a lot of these people grew up at a time when, you know, engineers were on one side of campus and right. The artists on the other side.
I think at the beginning, we're very lucky to have some real risk takers in terms of business people here in Milwaukee. And so at the beginning, we actually had buy-in fairly quickly, especially with Mike Lovell at the helm. I mean, that was a big bonus. It used to be taught by Mike.
That's our chancellor, our leader.
Yeah, right. And he's the real deal. I could spend this whole 20 minutes just gushing over him. But what we've had since then is major success. We've been teaching this class for 6 years. We've had 60 prototypes designed. And of those 60, 59 have gone into some form of production. That's not always the exact prototype. Sometimes it's gone as far as the exact prototype has gotten a patent and it's moving forward. And in the worst case scenario, it was the thing they built didn't work, but they had this one aspect of it that was completely unexpected that the company decided to take up and put into a next prototype that they're going to design. And only once did we have something that they didn't use anything, and we gave them free buy-in to the class the following semester.
And again, for the benefit of the listeners, there are companies in Milwaukee who bring a stash of cash, well, some money to you, some resources, some
assets. It's peanuts for them.
And they say, we have an idea. Here's some money and you guys work on it, right?
Yeah. And the students get – part of that goes to our overheads to make sure to maintain the lab. We like to think of ourselves in many ways as liaisons with local industry, right? We have to make sure we succeed.
Why can't the companies do it on their own?
Very often they could, but usually what they come to us with is an idea that would be it's not at the forefront of what's important to them. It's one of these ideas that's been lying around for a while that they meant to be working on and that they just don't have the resources to put to it. And so the buy-in costs are peanuts to them to see someone else get it to the point where then they want to focus their attention on it because it's doing something properly.
So it might not be as wild of an idea as honey and a bear at the top of the tower, but another idea that they maybe just put in a parking lot as opposed to saying, let's make this our priority.
Yeah, I mean, the ideas have ranged from designing certain kinds of bagging printers to a radio telescope, a high-frequency, high-amplitude radio telescope, to a new kind of light for planes, to casings for batteries for cars, to street signs that are solar-powered with their lights on top. I mean, it's a really diverse range. And we have to be careful. One of the things that we as teachers do, in addition to kind of giving them benchmarks and showing them how to think outside the box and then work towards prototyping, is making sure all of these product ideas that come to the class on the one hand are not too difficult for the students to be able to accomplish within one semester with the limited resources that we give them, but on the other hand also isn't too easy. We want them to be challenged. And so it has taken over in some, like we allow our students from mechanical engineering to take this class instead of senior project to give them a real world goal. And that's another thing that's often happened. And we start to tell students, think of this class in other ways as an interview, because a lot of these companies have hired students who have done really, really well.
And so you've got students both at the undergraduate and the graduate level working together?
It's mostly undergraduates because it's a 400 level class. However, we do get at least a few graduate students each semester, and we give them a little more responsibility with the harder projects then.
So let's talk a little bit about the student experience itself. You know, you've got students, you know, from Shawano, Wisconsin, who's down here in Milwaukee and think they're going to get their education and then go off and work somewhere. And suddenly they're already working with a company. They haven't yet even gotten their baccalaureate degree.
They're going and doing interviews at these places. They're looking at the factory. They're driving out to see how they're working. We've gotten also some amazing mentors from these companies. The sponsors differ from company to company and from semester to semester. But those who tend to have very successful outcomes from the class are those who will work with the students from week to week. And most of the time it's because they enjoy it. We had, for the first 10 semesters, one company always buy in every single semester with a different idea each time. And the representative from the company actually sat in on every single class every semester because she enjoyed it so much.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio is Nathaniel Stern. Nathaniel is an associate professor of art and design at the Peck School of the Arts, also a co-founder of the Student Startup Challenge, a marvelous program that bridges all of the different disciplines on campus where you bring students from different backgrounds together to work on real-world projects. Nathaniel, let's talk a little bit about the students themselves. How do they feel when they're in the midst of this incredible brainstorming petri dish laboratory of working on these sometimes far out ideas?
It's a good question, and I think that it really depends on the student. You know, the art and design students tend to have creativity inherent to their abilities, and then it's also something that's been nurtured for a very long time. And I don't think that creativity is something that we necessarily aren't already born with always. I mean, Picasso famously said, we're all born artists and then it's driven out of us. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. But rather that similar to how some people have an inclination towards working in maths and sciences or have an inclination with languages, there are people who are more inclined towards that. But that doesn't mean others can't learn to be more creative.
Is it intimidating, though, for an art student to, you know, presume that they would be with art students all 4 years and suddenly they're next to someone who actually understands algebra and calculus?
I think it can be. I mean, those students who come from majors like digital studio practice or interdisciplinary arts and technology, which have a bit of a technological edge to it, aren't intimidated at all when they come to this class. But some of the students from design and visual communication, from photography, when we've had painting students, are a bit intimidated. And especially when, with initiatives like STEM, science, technology, engineering, and maths, while they're important in terms of moving forward, they inherently devalue the arts and the humanities by not mentioning them. And so we have to reevaluate for those other students, hey, these are important things. You know, all science does is the how. We have to know the what and the why, and that comes from the arts and the humanities.
So maybe we should relabel the STEM instead of science, technology, engineering, and math. It should be STEMed, right? Science, technology, engineering, math, and design, which brings together the area that you are immersed in.
There's even a movement called STEM to STEAM right now, and the STEAM is science, technology, engineering, arts, and music. And arts in the broadest sense of both the liberal arts and arts and design and the way it's taught in Peck School of the Arts. And you're starting to see that more and more people are talking about this kind of thing. I think the Design Research Institute at UWM is going to try and do a two-day workshop on STEAM, if not this semester, next semester.
That's very cool. What about the engineering students? What about the people in the sciences who maybe did go through high school on a steady diet of math and science and biology, and maybe little or no exposure to art or design? Are they intimidated?
I think they are, and I think the way they respond to it is a little different. They know they're stepping outside of their comfort zone, and the easiest way for a student to handle that is to make fun of it or to downplay it. And we want to make sure it's a difficult balance because we want them to actually take it quite seriously and go somewhere at it. But what we want them to take seriously is the playfulness that's involved in that process that you need to not take seriously to come up with a bear climbing the cell phone tower, right? And so what's really important here is, and what we try to teach, is the valuing and the being able to speak each other's language of these two disciplines. I think this is why Ilya and I work so well together, in fact, is that I speak engineering because I have a PhD from engineering, and he speaks art because he really appreciates it. He goes to museums, he goes to galleries, he works with designers. And it's that mutual respect and that being able to speak each other's language that allows us to create things that are more than the sum of our parts. And that's what we're teaching in this class. We're teaching engineers not just to appreciate the arts, not just to be able to be creative, but be able to speak with artists. And we're teaching artists how to be able to speak with engineers. One of the things Ilya and I talk about is that it's actually impossible for an individual to be interdisciplinary at one time. To be in a discipline is to be disciplined. And that means that you have to do something really in depth and think in a very specific way. Now, I might be able to think as an engineer or think as an artist, but because one requires a more diffuse attention and one requires a more focused attention, I can't do both at the same time. And so to be truly interdisciplinary, you have to collaborate. You have to work with others. Now, I might be wearing my engineering hat at one point and my art hat at another point, but it's either at two different moments in time or with two different teams or both. And what we're trying to do here is say, okay, even if you can't be disciplined in another way, you can appreciate and work across disciplinary boundaries. And that's what's really important here.
Knowing that in the real world, in the work world today, those silos are being erased, they're tearing down the walls, and because the real winners in the business world are the ones who aren't afraid to tackle ideas in a new way.
That's exactly right. And you have to work together in order to do that, to be greater than the sum of all parts.
You talked a little bit about your background, but I'd like to delve a little bit deeper into Nathaniel Stern. I saw you do a presentation to our foundation board back in December where you were discussing some of your own personal project work, and I was blown away by some of the initiatives that you personally are engaged in.
Thank you very much. I suppose you want me to elaborate a bit. So for me, art is research and development for humanity. It's a very important project. The stakes could not be higher. And the specific artworks, the best of their kind, tend to amplify aspects of who and how we are, and more importantly, how we could be. So to me, art is about framing the potentials of being better as people and as a people. And so my work tends to start from that point and then go all over the map. So I'm thinking of one of the pieces that I presented there that is both funny and interesting to me that I was telling someone about over lunch, called Tweets in Space, where we took Twitter. For those of you listening, I'm sure you know it's a micro-blogging space where you have 140 characters to say anything you want to public and to each other. And we did my collaborator Scott Kilden and I did a 30-minute performance where anyone who added the tag Tweets in Space to their tweet, we would send out via a high-amplitude, high-frequency radio telescope towards GJ667cc, the closest and most likely exoplanet that might support human-like biological life. And on the one hand, we took the science really seriously, right? We hired a proper telescope. We worked with a few scientists to see what kind of signal we should send. And although obviously they don't speak English out there, if they're as intelligent as we are, they can do pattern recognition and see that it's an intelligent signal. But in the end, it wasn't. We had to take it seriously only to give it the potency that it would have about us. I've had others say it's like sending letters to God. It's like the Wailing Wall. You're sending messages out there. And in fact, more than that, you're doing so in dialogue because of the way Twitter works. We're not just performing doing a public performance. We're performing a public. And yeah, in the end, the messages ranged from don't eat us to Jimmy was here to what's your tax structure like. But if you take a step back from that, all 1,800 tweets, then you know that's curiosity and fear and existentialism. And it's actually quite beautiful. The two most common phrases, words other than "and" and "the" were "hello" and "peace."
So really, because you don't know what or if anyone is going to see or hear them on the other end. It really is an expression of how we view ourselves, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And we were shocked by and pleased by how gentle and warm and interesting so many of the messages were. It was really quite magical.
Other work. What else are you engaged in?
So one of the projects that I just completed, I've got two big projects that are actually coming back to Milwaukee after both being in South Africa this coming October. One of them, I got a Research Growth Initiative grant from UWM to build a suite of interactive installations which use body tracking and motion tracking software in order to trigger video and sound in the space. And so it's a suite of four interactive installations where every movement triggers spoken word and animated text. I call it body language, and it really tells us something about the relationship between how we move and how we make meaning, and asks us to understand what a big difference and impact our movements make, both on a personal scale, but also in terms of the climate and ecology and ecological systems around us. And so that was just at the Wits Art Museum in South Africa.
And I think I saw the demonstration.
You saw one of the pieces,
one of the pieces. And it's amazing. There's a projector, and you actually can walk into this scene and participate, right?
Yeah, so I'll describe one of the pieces since you bring it up. One of them is called Stuttering, and it's for those of you out there who know the painter Modrian, he does the red squares and the primary colored squares. Imagine 34 of those squares, except instead of being filled with primary colors, they're filled with spoken word and animated text. And when you walk in front of the piece, you see an outline of yourself. And anytime your body crosses any one of the squares, it recites spoken word and it animates that text. So if you move really quickly in front of the piece, the whole thing stutters. You can't understand a word it's saying. But if you move really slowly, cautiously, carefully, all of a sudden, meaning emerges. And so it's actually asking us to move and speak with much more care. You can actually see, I actually watch people who immediately they run and they jump, and then inevitably, whether they're a 4-year-old or a 70-year-old or anything in between, they slow down and they start to stutter with their body, and they start to teach each other, hey, this is how you move with this piece. Hey, this is what you do. And all of a sudden, it becomes a communal space of learning how to communicate with a bit more care. For me, that's full of wonder. It's a really great way to play and learn with the public. So all four of those are going to be shown at the Myad Leighton Galleries next in the fall of October of this year.
So we said at the beginning of the program, we're going to talk about the creative process. Where did that idea come from? Where the heck did that come from?
It's a good question. And, you know, everyone thinks that art just comes from this, like, inspirational moment. That, you know, all of a sudden you have a great idea. And I always like to compare that to, you know, with Marcel Duchamp's fountain. You know, he took that urinal and stuck it in a museum. And, you know, he didn't work for it and he came up with it in a moment. And it's considered the most influential work of contemporary art. But if you ask every artist alive today, what work has most influenced you? That will be the most common answer. And so people say, but he did it in 1 minute. Yeah, 50 years in 1 minute. You know, this has been a lifetime of background of thinking and making and working and playing and ideation. So that series of works I started in the year 1999 and I finished in the year 2013.
Could you have done it without your technical background, your knowledge of engineering and other sciences?
I don't think so. But that doesn't mean that other artists might not have been able to. And because for me, technology is my sketch pad. Technology is where I play. And it's also those enabling constraints that I can think with. I think that when I made the first piece, part of it was experimenting with the technologies of the day and seeing what I could do and push at the limits. At the same time, I might not have thought of it if I wasn't pushing at those the limits that existed. There are artists who work with new media technologies that don't know how to code and that don't know how to work with it, and they'll hire someone else to do it. For me, working through it is like working with my materials and my craft. But I came out of a space of before I worked with technology, I was a musician and I wrote lyrics and I was a spoken word artist. And so that bled into my workings with technology.
If you didn't know coding, could you have found someone to partner with and would the results be the same?
I could have found someone to partner with. I don't think the results would have been the same. Funnily enough, the first few pieces that I made on my own. And then when I got this grant to work on it, I actually decided to use that to help mentor students at UWM. So I hired and paid for grad school for a computer science student named Neetu Katyar. She was a master's of science student in the comp sci department. And we both learned so much from each other. And she absolutely had an impact on the aesthetics of the piece.
The other day or last week when we were talking to your colleagues, your counterparts involved in the Student Startup Challenge, I asked them, so where do you see this thing going? You know, 10 years, 15 years down the road after UWM has had a decade of giving students thousands of dollars, teams of students, thousands of dollars each year to take their idea and turn it into something. Are we going to end up with companies here in Milwaukee? What do you envision down the road?
I think so. I think we're going to see industry come back to Milwaukee, and we're going to see some of the best leaders in the country and in the city coming out of UWM.
Yeah. And as far as the student opportunity, do you think that's going to attract a different type of student knowing that this exists in a place like UWM?
I hope so. I think that what's interesting about UWM to me is that it's the university within the UW system that attracts the most Wisconsin students, and that the most Wisconsin students that graduate with advanced degrees stay here in Wisconsin. And so I think as goes UWM, goes Milwaukee, and as goes Milwaukee, goes the state. And so we're starting to already see a much more international base of students here in Milwaukee. But our concern on top of that, and our concern with that is that this is a long-term investment in our entire city and state.
Yeah. And in terms of attracting other types of students too, is that likely when you have programs such as this?
Absolutely. We're starting to see many more international students and many more students interested in starting their own companies already coming and specifically asking about the Startup Challenge, especially in engineering and a bit in Lubar. And we're seeing more technological students find an interest in studying the arts.
Yeah, because this is still atypical. Most universities still have a pretty traditional approach to delivering the product, the education.
Mm-hmm. One of the things Ilya and I talk about is that, you know, real innovation happens in the hallways, in the coffee shops. It happens in the in-between spaces of the classroom. And that doesn't mean that the classroom is unnecessary. I mean, you always hear stories of, you know, Steve Jobs and, you know, people at Microsoft, et cetera, being these quote-unquote college dropouts. And what I always say is, yeah, college dropouts. They went to college, and they were there, and that's where the idea came from, and then they decided to move on. So we're trying to foster those in-between spaces at the college as well.
Well, Nathaniel, thank you for sharing your thoughts, your insights, both on the Student Startup Challenge at UWM, as well as the whole creative process. We wish you continued great success.
Thank you.
Nathaniel Stern, Associate Professor of Art and Design at the Peck School of the Arts, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Well, that's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week back here at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.